Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium. My name is Nigella Hillgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome you all to the latest Perspectives on Ocean Science lectures. Now, these are named the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science. And it gives me particular pleasure tonight to introduce Jeffrey B. Graham, who is going to give us a very special lecture tonight. And Jeff is a very special person. He got his PhD here in 1970 at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he's been here pretty much ever since. He is a very distinguished researcher and marine biologist here at Scripps, and he is a world expert on many areas of marine biology, particularly fish, and particularly air-breathing fishes, and on sharks, about which he's going to speak tonight. So we're very, very lucky to have Jeff. So Jeff, without further ado, please come and tell us about sharks.
So thanks, Nigella. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for all coming out. I titled this Sharks, Things Old, Things New. And the purpose of having that presentation is I wanted to give you initially some grounding in the fundamentals of shark biology. And so just for review for most of you, if you're a fan of the aquarium at all, you know that sharks are members of the class Chondrichthyes, which has two distinct features, the presence of a cartilaginous skeleton, not a bony skeleton, but a cartilaginous skeleton, and also the presence of claspers. Claspers are devices that enable the male shark to, in fact, penetrate the inside of the female and transmit sperm by means of internal fertilization. And this is an age-old practice in vertebrates. It goes back in deep time to the origin of this particular group and perhaps some others that were present in the Paleozoic some 350 to 400 million years ago. In the meantime, I want to introduce to you the subclass Elasmobranchii, which includes the sharks and the rays. And the term elasmobranch, I gave a lecture last Wednesday night up at the Long Beach Aquarium, and I asked everybody, who knows what elasmobranch means? And everybody looked at me, except for this little six-year-old girl who raised her hand and says, it has to do with the specialization of their gills. And we'll talk about that. The term means essentially strapped gills, gills that are, in fact, attached to a septum, to a structure that grows out of the gill arch. And again, the elasmobranchs have been around since probably late in the Paleozoic. The modern elasmobranchs that we see today have a direct ancestry to groups that can be identified as being very similar to them, extending back into the Cretaceous, maybe as far as 100 million years ago. So the important point to make is that the elasmobranchs have been around for a very, very long time. They are apex predators, primarily all carnivores, and they have had a long existence, a very successful life, doing pretty much the same thing for year in and year out. Now, what I need to do is to introduce the concept of physiology, the science of physiology. Physiologists study vital processes, vital life processes in organisms. Breathing is a vital life process. Sensory biology, cardiovascular function, muscle function, thermoregulation, all these things are vital physiological processes. And a comparative physiologist is a person who makes a study of that compares aspects of animal or other organism function with regard to how the environment influences that, whether there be changes in temperature or changes in salinity. And also the comparative physiologist spends a good deal of his time looking at aspects of the function of an organism that are directly attributable to its evolutionary history. So for an example, we can just look at this evolutionary relationships amongst the vertebrates. I don't expect you to memorize this. But I want to, and I'll show you an appended version of this in a moment. But here are the sharks here. Here are most of the more derived groups of vertebrates, including the reptiles and the mammals, which all arrived on the Earth in a much later time than did these early forms. And to summarize that in a more condensed version, I apologize, Dick Rosenblatt's in the front row, and this is not a good phylogeny, but it serves our purposes, because what it enables me to do is to show you the cartilaginous fishes and to point out from a comparative standpoint that we have the opportunity to compare cartilaginous fishes in their various forms with the ray fin fishes, which includes the tunas, basses, other kinds of organisms, the very diverse group of fishes that live on the planet today. So that's the kind of thing that comparative physiologists study. Now, what I want to do is to emphasize to you that there's a little bit of shark in all of us. Or perhaps, as Orway said, there's a little bit of lawyer in all of us, if you want to extend it that far. And what I'm showing you here, just to illustrate this, is a series of depictions of the early embryonic development of a fish, a salamander, all the way over to a human. And you can see they all go through these stages of growth, when in fact there are these pouches that develop below the head or at the base underneath where the eyeball is. And those pouches appear in all of these vertebrate groups early in the embryonic development. Now you can see this is a shark because you can see the external gills here. But the important point to make that was first learned by embryologists 150 years ago is that these structures, the structures that form in the throat of human beings and the structures that form in the throat or in the branchial region, the gill region of a shark are very much the same, and they have the same origins, the same kinds of embryonic tissue. However, the matter in which those develop and the fate of those things, the developmental fate of those, varies quite differently. So that gives you a little sense of what is a common feature of all of the vertebrates in terms of the strong importance of the evolutionary heritage that we can first see in developing sharks. Here's another example of this, and I call this breathing 101, getting smoke to come out of your ears, or why is that stingray winking at me? And this simply talks about this particular evolutionary process whereby the first two arches of a primitive vertebrate form into the jaw, and the most importantly, the hyomandibular structure that supports the jaw, leaving in behind one little gill opening, a gill cleft here, and this develops here then and still remains, and this is called the spiracle. The spiracle is something you can see in any stingray in this aquarium, or any ray, in fact, and some sharks have it. The spiracle is a structure, if you take a cutting through a ray, a big window on top that leads down to the pharynx and allows the fish, when it's sitting on the bottom with its mouth in the mud, to essentially breathe through holes in the top of its head. Well, it turns out, interestingly, the pharynx is the homologue of the Eustachian tubes. So, in fact, if you were to perforate the eardrum, you could, in fact, pass smoke out through your ears, a small amount of smoke. You couldn't breathe through it. But the point is that this structure is the evolutionary homologue of the spiracle, and it can be traced back to this early development processes. Now, what I want to do is to pay homage to some very important Scripps biologists who preceded me and who made fundamental contributions to an area of sensory biology. I like this figure. It's taken from a book called Sharks in Question, which was a book produced by the Smithsonian Natural History Museum in response to the most frequently asked questions. It's probably for sale here in the aquarium bookshop, but it simply allows you to look at sound, olfaction, lateral line, vision, ampullae, and contact sense, actual physical contact, as all being sensory modalities exploited by sharks. Of these, we have some imagination of how these work. We know that low-frequency sounds from a matter of kilometers can probably attract sharks to a certain site. We know they are capable of scenting or of detecting a small concentration of something in the water and then doing what we call an olfactory corridor penetration, where they stay in contact with that stream and follow it in until they get to the site of whatever it is that might be producing something that smells like it's going to be good to them. The lateral line is, again, something which we don't have a lot of sense or understanding of, but the best way to explain lateral line function to you is to say, well, we're standing on this corner, a big bus goes by, and we feel the pressure of that bus go by. As it goes by, you feel the wind and the shift of the air as it moves around you. That would be comparable to lateral line sensation. And then, of course, we get in here to vision. And what I want to point out to you is the last 25 years have seen a great increase in understanding about the sensory capabilities of sharks insofar as vision is concerned. For example, sharks are now known to be able to see color vision. It's also thought initially that sharks were continually far-sighted. They couldn't see anything near field. It turns out now that a lot of the first kinds of data obtained on that particular parameter was done by capturing sharks and putting them on a table and then measuring the optical properties through their eye and what kind of focus thing they could obtain. Well, it turns out now when people take the time to get sharks swimming steadily in an aquarium and as they go by use instruments that allow them to shoot light into the eye and focus it back, they can see rather clearly that these eyes are in focus. They are emmetropic, that is, they can see something clear, and that they have a good acute vision for things within 1 or 2 meters of their eyes. Also, as I've mentioned, sharks are now known to be capable of color vision. The other thing I want to talk about, of course, is the electric senses. This is something that we have no affinity with, we can't understand it, and so I'll talk about that in the context of two things. Another thing, first of all, that we've learned about sharks is they have extremely large brains relative to most other cold-blooded vertebrates. These are data that were actually obtained by Glenn Northcutt, a colleague of ours here at Scripps, a neurobiologist who has spent a number of years studying aspects of sensory biology in sharks. But the electrical sense has its basis in structures called the ampullae of Lorenzini. Here they are here. You can see them look like little freckles underneath the rostrum of this Mako shark. And these ampullae are jelly-filled structures that have the capacity to sense electrical currents emanating from organisms that are alive but perhaps buried in the sand, and so they cannot see them. The thing I can tell you from firsthand experience is all the chumming I have done for sharks, you put in some cut-up mackerel, and this mackerel makes an olfactory field. The sharks come in, they look around, all they see is a bucket in the water, and they smell everything good, and they're looking all around for something to chew on because they know something's got to be there, and they pass by the motor of the boat, which has its aluminum, and it's got a little bit of electrical potential associated with it, and they grab the motor, they grab the prop, and they start shaking the boat like this, and that's because they have this capacity to sense this electrical discharge. Here's some experiments done by Adrianus Calmeen, who is retired now from Scripps. And Calmeen's experiments done with flounder buried in sand. Buries a flounder here. The shark can easily find it. He puts the flounder in there, but now he covers it by something that an auger plate, which has no scent but has bioelectric field. He can now come up and hone in on this thing, no scent, but can still sense this. Now flounder scent and field both shielded, so something here to keep the shark from sensing it, and the shark just goes right by. And then finally, just a set of electrodes putting out a small current, shark goes right to it and starts digging for something to eat. It's been said that the voltage sensitivity of sharks is of this nature. That is, you take a 1.5-volt battery and put it in Denver, took one lead and put it in Boston, and the other lead in San Francisco, and put that all underwater, then the shark could detect that very small voltage difference. What I want to do now, though, is to talk about some aspects of the research that's gone on in my laboratory and the relationship to the two fundamental properties I've spoken to you about regarding sharks and chondrichthyes, namely, and first of all, the cartilaginous skeleton. Just to show you this skeleton, here it is. It's cartilaginous. Sharks do not have bone. Sharks have calcifications that occur in their jaws and in their vertebral column that are bone-like, but it's not the same growth process as bone. So it's a very different process and has different terminology. The cells that from which those calcium deposits come are quite different, and the formation of those is a very different process. You can see the skeleton. Notice down here the vertebral size gets much less because the tail has to be flexible for swimming. And the gills are supported by cartilaginous rods. The skull, which you call the neurocranium, is again all cartilage, as are the jaws, but they can be reinforced by calcium hydroxyapatite deposits. These structures here, the ceratotrichia, this is what makes shark fin soup so popular, these structures here. And that's what, in fact, you eat when you eat shark fin soup, is those structures. Well, cartilage is this kind of structure, like I have in my ears or my nose. And the question is, how do sharks swim with that? We know a lot from biomechanics about how muscles have to have a strong and solid surface against which to pull to, in fact, develop a force. And the fundamental question then is, how does shark cartilage support that? Well, the answer is that sharks essentially build themselves differently. And we'll talk about that in the following respect. First of all, here's a sort of a cut open shark and a cut open bony fish to illustrate a couple of differences. You can see differences in the fin shape, but also here is an AB, an air bladder, which is a buoyancy organ. Sharks do not have a buoyancy organ of that kind. Rather, they have very large livers. Livers have lots of oils that can, in fact, support the body. Now, buoyancy is an important factor because it changes the specific gravity or the density of the organism in the water, but it doesn't really affect swimming power production. And the cost of swimming through the water is still very great, irrespective of whether or not there's a buoyancy organ present. A lot of textbooks, a lot of people who think about these things don't keep that distinction in place. You can see the position of what's called the pelvic and the pectoral fins separated here, and here's the pectoral fin on a bony fish here, and the pelvic fin advanced forward. Well, as I mentioned, one of the aspects of shark propulsion has to do with how they can, in fact, develop force if they have a skeleton that maybe isn't up to developing or holding or essentially anchoring the muscles as strongly as might a bony skeleton. And the answer is that sharks are surrounded by a helix of collagen fibers that wrap around, much like a Chinese finger puzzle, and essentially support the body from the outside. Here's a diagram of this for a hammerhead shark. Here's a SEM illustration of the skin showing these layers of filaments that are in this particular angle coming right out of the screen towards us, and then some that are running more or less parallel to the screen down here. And similarly here, here's a section through the skin. This is the epidermis on top. Here's a chromatophore. Here's a placoid scale. Here's these layers of filaments, and you can see the circles coming towards us, layers of those separated from layers going the opposite direction. This wrapping essentially gives the animal an external compression and a way of, in fact, supporting the body and contributing to force generation. The skin is actually then a very important part of propulsion in sharks. Now, sharks swim in different ways. Some sharks have a mode of swimming that's much like that of tunas and is called thunniform, which means, in fact, that they can get by with keeping their body fairly stiff and just moving their tail like this. Others use more elaborate forms of lateral motion in which the body develops more waves into it, all the way down to something anguilliform, which is, again, a name taken from eels, and essentially there would be a lot of ropey coils as this fish swam along. But one product of all, one consequence of any type of swimming motion is the occurrence of what I'll define for you now as the increase in inside or internal pressures as a consequence of the squeezing and muscle contraction. Now, I have developed this slide just to illustrate this point because I'll talk about most of these things. But imagine a shark swimming along, and it has, if it continues to swim or if it speeds up, it is continually exerting a pressure associated with the contraction of the different sides of its body continuously. And this pressure is relieved by a series of plumbing connections that connect the chamber of the heart, called the pericardium, with the visceral cavity, and then through a set of openings at the base of the abdomen, base of the visceral cavity, called the abdominal pores. Now, this is not excretory system. This is not a urinary tract. These are just a way of, like scupper valves in a sailboat, a way of getting water out of the hull, if you will, as the fish swims. Also associated with these fish is the hearing organ up here in the skull that has an endolymphatic duct. This duct actually opens in the roof of the skull. So there is potentially some connection here between hydrostatic pressures induced by swimming actions and the relieving of pressure here to conserve sensitivity. No one's collected any data on this. This is something I just started thinking about as I was preparing to talk about that. But what I can talk about is this particular relationship, because this essentially is work that has gone on in my laboratory. Just to illustrate this, the kinds of things that cause these spatial displacements, taking big bites, pregnancy, swimming pressure, is it a vestige of having a very thick body armor? All of these things fit into place. For example, other animals with abdominal pores, crocodiles, big thick armors, turtles, some bony fish have them as well. So these kinds of things need to be thought about in the context of what kind of pressure and hydrostatic or hydraulic compensation is required. And another thing I want to emphasize for you is that sharks are different from mammals, and they have no sympathetic innervation. Heart transplant patients have no sympathetic innervation. Sympathetic nerve is cut when, in fact, a heart is transplanted. Now, primitive fish hearts work very differently from those of mammals, even in more derived fish groups, because, first of all, the old idea that the heart functioned by suction is going to be replaced, and what I'll tell you now, by the idea that these hearts are specialized in the absence of sympathetic innervation for making rapid adjustments in cardiac output, rapid sudden adjustments in cardiac output. If I were to trot around this room a couple times, my heart rate would go up, so would yours, and the consequence of that would be that we would pump more blood. Sharks, however, without sympathetic innervation cannot accelerate their hearts to the same extent. This is not to say they don't have ways through hormones like adrenaline and noradrenaline, which are stored in large venous sinuses, of a changing heart rate, but an instant change in heart rate, instant change in stroke volume of the heart can be achieved by a hydromechanical mechanism, hence this section on rapid shifts in heart function. Sharks have a structure, lasmobranchs have a structure, called the pericardial peritoneal canal, PPC. Here it is written down here, pericardial peritoneal canal. And this is a connection which is like a flapper valve that allows the heart pericardium to drain into the visceral cavity. And what I'm going to tell you about now is the kind of experiments we've done to investigate its function. Just to show you a fluoroscopic picture of this, here's the pericardial chamber of a shark that's been filled with a radio-opaque substance, and you can see that it's all white. So nothing's getting through there, but you can see the pericardial peritoneal coming out here, the canal there. You can see inside view coming out here. And this particular thing is a catheter. We develop a technique for taking a shark and inserting a catheter up through the coracoid into the base of the pericardium, and essentially so we could measure pressure and volume. And that's very key to the kind of experiments I'll talk to you about. We took a large bat ray, and we started with the pericardial peritoneal canal open. And we simply infused volume, and we saw that this would go up to some point, and then it would just not go up anymore, because what we do, we're filling the pericardium, and all the fluid was simply pouring out into the abdominal cavity. Okay, the next step was to take that pericardial peritoneal canal and tie it off, surgically tie it off, and then do the same experiment, and we could get this pressure to spike like this, until a point when the sutures actually gave way and all this fluid was released. So the pericardial peritoneal canal is a way of passing fluid from around the heart and exiting it out. And so Daniel Abel in my laboratory did some experiments where he made long-term pressure measurements of horn shark. Daniel made very precise measurements of the pressure in these animals, and he kept them in captivity for a month, just measuring these pressures and to seeing what they're like. And what Daniel essentially showed is that long-term measures, forgive the spelling there, show pericardial pressures not near ambient. That is, they are not at ambient, that is the same as the hydrostatic pressure, but just slightly below, but not nearly as great, as much depressed as the early workers had thought about strongly negative pressures. Also, Daniel did two other interesting experiments. One was he had a shark experiment set up where he was measuring a pulse pressure, which is, imagine a stiff chamber which inside the heart is beating, and as it goes into systole and then diastole, the pressure oscillates. And this is called a pulse pressure. So here's that pulse pressure difference. And as he infused volume, slowly closed down these pressures to the point where the pulse pressure was now very much constricted. Imagine, it's called tamponade when a person is injured and the blood in the heart actually escapes and fills the pericardial chamber and actually prevents the heart from beating. But here can do the same thing now with pericardial fluid, and then to a point where the pericardial peritoneal canal would empty, and at this point then the pulse pressures would be resolved. Also, Daniel did a very interesting set of experiments. He had resting sharks sitting with oscillating pericardial pressure, and then he proceeded to just startle this guy, bang on the cage, bang on the side of the tank, reach in and touch it, and there would be an immediate ejection of fluid, pulse pressure now much greater than it was here. So what we needed to do was to do some experiments where we could actually test the relationship between this mechanism for releasing volume from around the heart and what its consequences would be for a swimming fish. So introduced the work of N.C. Lai, who finished in my laboratory and has now worked at the School of Medicine. And Lai actually did experiments on leopard shark. To make a long story short about Lai's experiments, here's what he did. He was able to surgically implant a flow meter on the major blood vessel leaving the heart, the ventral aorta. He was also then able to, with using this coracoid bar catheter, able to go in and measure the volume and the pressure of the pericardium here. And then what he did is he had animals that were resting. And then he had animals that were swimming. And then he had animals that were post-swimming or resting again, post-swimming rest. And what he saw was as follows. A resting fish has a stroke volume. That is, each stroke of the heart produces this magnitude of flow. It's a flow meter record of, say, just put it in arbitrary units, it could be 0.77 mLs of fluid come out. This would be dependent on the size of the fish. He then found when he made these fish swim, this volume went up to 1.02. And you can see here, we've illustrated this as a larger heart, and there has been a drop, an excess, a blowout of fluid, because what he could do was he could measure how much fluid was around this pericardium. And what he found is that here's a plus, an increase from there of about 0.4, and an increase, a drop in volume here of about 0.6. Then in the resting condition, post-swimming condition, a very, very large flow and a very, very large heart with a very, very low volume. So what we have here is a situation where a shark can shift its gears almost like this and go from a low cardiac output to a high cardiac output, not by changing its heart rate, but by changing rather the size of each stroke of its heart. And that was a pretty impressive thing, and so we gave him a PhD for that. And the interesting thing, and probably the rewarding thing any scientist can look to, is where his contributions to a field warrant inclusion in a textbook. So here's 1978 version of sort of shark cardiovascular dynamics, where we have these four chambers just more or less illustrated in series. So atrium, ventricle, conus, actually not even showing the sinus venosus. And then showing that there's contraction. Here's ventricular contraction, and then here's the expansion of the conus and contraction there, showing how this works. This is 1978 version. Here's the 2002 version, showing, in fact, now the pericardial peritoneal canal is now part of this. And some of the text down here refers to the fact that there is, in fact, fluid ejected, which changes, immediately changes the stroke volume and hence the cardiac output of this fish. Well, Lai had one other trick he was going to do before he finished his PhD work, and this was to attack a problem that had been known for a long time, which was the biphasic filling pattern of the ventricle, something old that was not known. The standard view of shark heart function was that the atrium fills the ventricle. Just to sort of keep this in place, let's look here at a ventricular systole. The ventricle is just contracted, so all the blood's been ejected here. The next step, while this is happening, is the atrium is filling. So this is emptying, this is filling, and as this happens, then the next step is for the atrium to fill the ventricle. So this would happen like this. So the concept was, well, this fills this, and then ejects out, and then recycles itself. Well, we thought about that, and then and this is a true story. We took a shark, leopard shark, horn shark, and we put it on a hospital gurney, and we put white cloth over the top of it. We stuck some tennis shoes at one end. And underneath, this sheet was hanging down far enough so that we put a life support system underneath there. We had all the water pumping and all the stuff you need for portable survival of the shark. And we hauled it down to University Hospital and took it in. Because in the early times, there was only one place or two places where you could do ultrasonic imaging of sharks, of hearts at the time. We actually had to take it to the pediatric unit because they had a small probe. So we got it in there and we started making measurements. Well, quickly things changed. These units became portable. We actually took one, a big truck, and brought it down to our laboratory. And Lai did some more experiments. And what I'll do now is simply show you a tracing that Lai made. What you're seeing now is electrocardiogram down here. So ventricular systole. These are little phases where the atrium fills and then contracts, so on and so forth. And what you'll see now, and this is upside down, by the way, the probe is up here looking in, and what you'll see is the atrium right here. And you'll watch now, and what I want to show you is the atrium's going to fill now. It's filling, and then we're going to see a little bit of red go out here. Now watch this. Kaboosh. And so this is the ventricle down here. So we see that again. There's that kaboosh. We watch it again now. Blood squirts into the atrium. A little bit comes out. A little bit more now, and kaboosh. So here was the idea that this heart, this shark heart, was functioning just like a mammal heart. In a mammal heart, there's what we call an early phase of ventricular filling. That occurs before the atrium, before the atria contract. And this ventricular filling then is augmented by when the atria actually contracts. So there's early and late filling aspects of heart function, and what Lai's work essentially did was to show that this was, in fact, something that has a very primitive origin and has been around for millions and millions of years. What we've done since that is to go back and start surveying lots of different fish groups to try to document biphasic filling in lots of other fish groups. And we can do this now, but that work has been more or less put on the back burner for the time. We just haven't had time to work on it. What I want to do now is change. I want to stay on the emphasis of the cartilaginous support of swimming and just point out to you this picture on the left, which is two sections of different fish. These are blue sharks, and here's the male on the left and the female on the right, and you can tell the difference because the female has a much thicker skin. See there? Now, that's not just because they're tolerant of male abuse, but actually during sex, the male bites the female, holds on to her, so they have to have a thicker skin. That's not the subject right now we're going to talk about. What we want to talk about, however, is this little compact area of what's called red muscle, which is right around the edges of the body in these sharks. Typically, if you catch a shark and slice it open like this, you would find the red muscle on the side. Well, what is red muscle? Red muscle is heavily pigmented muscle. It's pigmented with a substance called myoglobin, which is an oxygen-binding substance and an oxygen-collecting substance. And where that's present, there's lots of oxygen. So imagine these sharks swimming by simply pulling this red muscle on both sides, essentially activating the tail or bending the body. These red muscle stripes, as indicated here, go all the way down the side of the body. Here's a dogfish down here. So imagine an in-series set of contractions going all the way down the body and, in fact, generating thrust at the caudal fin. Well, I show this because I wanted to point out to you a case of comparative physiology where laminid sharks, that's the mako, the great white, poor beagle, salmon shark, all have properties that are much like those of tunas. And these properties have to do not only where this red muscle occurs, for as in a dogfish it might occur from here all the way down to the tail, in a laminid shark it occurs not far back in the tail, not as far back on the body. Similarly for tunas. So what I'm going to introduce now is some aspects of shark specializations that are like those of tuna. Remind you that comparative physiologists are interested in how organisms express convergent evolution. That is, what patterns about life forms can really be indicated by how the environment and the ecological requirements of a particular species impact its physiology. And here's a picture. This is a magnetic resonance image of the red muscle packs in a salmon shark. Here's a picture of a mako shark. Again, MRI images of those, and you can see that this red muscle is up far in the body, and it's in the middle of the body. It's not along the edge of the skin, and in transverse sections, you can see this work. You can see the red muscle in the core near the backbone. So imagine now we're talking about a swimming mechanism that involves not pulling from the side like this, but rather lining these babies up right next to the backbone and doing this. And this stake of red muscle that's actually buried in here, you can see it. It's quite flexible. It moves with respect to the other body muscle around it back and forth like this. So imagine a big shark swimming along just using these packets of red muscle to develop thrust with its caudal fin, which is way, way back here. The red muscle's up here, long tendons connect to the tail region and force the activity of the force generation. Now, why you say, okay, well, this is interesting, but what's it got to do with the rest of the shark's function? All of this muscle around it is like a huge battery just waiting to be activated should there be some need to really get going. See something to eat, they take off, they don't longer cruise, but they start now swimming very fast, and all of this muscle around it would then be pulled into action. Well, this was a stimulus for some work in my laboratory by Diego Bernal, and Bernal was able to actually quantify these red muscle positions in sharks living in Alaska, salmon sharks, and actually show that they were in fact capable of generating force at a greater force because they were warmer. Again, tuna and laminid comparisons, this is the family that includes the mako and of course tunas. And the example here of convergent evolution. Tunas and makos are convergent in many respects, tail form, body shape, endothermy, and relatively large gill areas. Compared to other sharks, makos have larger gill area. Compared to all other fishes, tunas have much larger gill area. Nick Wegner in my laboratory just finished his PhD, and he studied essentially mako-ram ventilation. There's another property which makos and tunas are convergent, and that is this need to swim through the water and hold their mouth open and essentially obtain oxygen by just forcing water over their gills. It's a lot like when you were a kid and you used to ride your bicycle really fast, and the faster you went, the more you breathed, and you were really having a good time until you sucked in a few flies. And then you had to stop and get rid of them and then continue. And so this kind of idea of ram ventilation is something that Nick studied, and here's just a contrast to what gills of a tuna might look like if we were to look down from the top. These arches with these gills coming back like this. Elasmobranch is a little bit different in the sense it has these arches, but the term elasmobranch is strapped gills. And so you can see that these gills are in fact attached in a strap-like form to the flap of the gill. Here's the arch. Arch comes back, and this septum along here comes all the way to the outside. when you see a shark from the outside, you see these gill slits, you're actually seeing these flaps, and the gill arches are attached to that. So the mechanics of breathing and the mechanics of ram ventilation are different because in this particular case, in the case of a shark, the water has to come through, it has to turn in and go like this, and then it hits that septum and comes out. In contrast, tuna gill works just like this. Water comes in, goes right over the top of the gill, and once it's past the gill, it's free and clear. Tunas have, or elasmobranchs have this extra wrinkle. And so ram ventilation raises a number of questions about how this might function. And just to illustrate this, here's a drawing Nick did of a Mako shark ram ventilating, showing the gill arch like this, with the flow having to come in and go through, make these corners. He did an MRI image of this, and we'll see that. So here's water coming in. Now this image flips. So we're looking down inside. Water's coming through here. This is where it's crossing the oxygen exchange parts. Then it's going to come out here like this and go out to the side. And so here's an example then of how this flow has to make it through. And so Nick took on a fairly interesting set of experiments in that what he did was to put these animals in a chamber and make some measurements of their actual oxygen consumption. Here then, at the other end, are these septal channels. The septum is here. This is what comes out to the edge of the body. And so flow has to pass, as these arrows indicate, through the lamellae and then come out these septal channels. The actual water has to pass, the flow water has to pass between these spaces and the red cells, of course, are inside the gills, in the gill lamellae themselves. And this would be the exchange surface between the water and the red cell. So Nick did these experiments. We have this tunnel that we developed to swim Makos in. And here's a footage of that. And then what Nick did was to get his instruments ready to go and then step up alongside of these fish and actually make measurements of the oxygen extraction factor for these gills. You see how large these gills are? And they're all open, and what the process would be take an oxygen-sensing wand, step in there and make these measurements, and that's what he did. Make a long story short, Nick was able to go in and make these measurements at these different points on each of the arches and to measure the oxygen extraction factor. Now, what I should tell you is that if there's 100% oxygen coming through, that is the maximum amount of oxygen in the water coming through, the fish could take out 46%, 20%, 75%. So the average extraction for the whole gill arch is about 53%, which is much like that of a tuna. These fish are swimming at an average speed of 0.4 body lengths per second. To make a long story short about shark reproductive biology, there are kinds of sharks that actually produce an egg and lay that egg. There are sharks that actually retain an egg inside of their body for a long period of time until it's about ready to hatch. And then they release it. There are sharks that actually have no egg case around them, but actually have a large yolk sac that nourishes the embryo when it's developed. And then when all that yolk is gone, the youngsters are born. There are sharks, remember there are two uteri in a female. There are sharks that actually, a bunch of eggs are fertilized. The first shark that hatches out and uses all of its yolk turns around and eats all the other guys. And stays and gets pretty big for that regard. There are some sharks that actually have a placenta and develop out of their yolk sac, once that's emptied, an intimate contact with the uterus, and then get nourishment from the female. Okay, so that's, in a sense, shark reproductive biology. It's the kind of reproductive biology that comes when an organism is, in fact, pretty immune from predation and pretty much secure in terms of having not a large number of threats to its life history. And so what we can say about sharks is that most of them are precocial. Young are born as miniature versions of the adults, ready to fend for themselves. Females have some capacity to go to certain areas and to release their pups in an area where the big males can't get them, or something like that. These called idea of nursery areas. And so these kinds of things go on. And so what we can do is we can contrast then quickly shark reproductive biology with that of a tuna. Here's the two comparisons. Here's a blue shark, 100 or so young mom can produce 100 or so young each year. Mother eggs holds these eggs till full term. Pups are born as functional fish, ready to go, the precocial term. Because of moms, pups have a good chance for survival. No risk of mortality in early life stages as long as the mom survives. And you can see here what happens if the mom doesn't survive. Contrast that with a tuna, an adult tuna, might have millions of eggs in a season. Some of these tropical tunas are probably producing eggs monthly, if not weekly. The eggs are fertilized outside the body. They exist as they drift as eggs and then hatch and then turn to larvae. The larvae have to survive in the plankton. Then they transform, metamorphosis into juveniles, continue to school, and then have to make their way up to adult, up to reproductive size. So in a good year, millions of eggs become a few adults. So it's a very different strategy. The people who work on this field about the evolution of population strategies speak of this properties as hedging the bets in terms of what is the best way to reproduce. Well, I have an inside flash for you tonight because I've gotten, through my intelligence gathering, some alien report on the planet Illozuria, which is the name for Earth given to it by aliens. And here's a particular set of text that describes this planet somewhere way out there because of this high intelligent form, somewhere way out there. So they keep track of it, and they have this report that exists. But they observed a new phenomenon just recently, which was all of these series of lights showing up, or these bright spots showing up on what should be the dark side of this planet. First thought was some kind of infestation. And so they sent some probes to see what it was. And in fact, these drawings show, in fact, over time, that in fact there was a large number of, an infestation, leading to the point that the planet was essentially being submerged in people. And here's to make a play on the cartoon from the Jaws commercial. Here's fins. And now the turnaround is done in the sense that sharks are no longer the apex predators of the ocean. Humans are. And because of their reproductive biology, they don't have a chance of surviving unless we move to some kind of controlled management system or some way of conserving them. And so when I knew this for a long time and I thought about it and I decided, well, maybe we should start moving in my laboratory towards trying to solve these kinds of problems. So back in the early part of this decade, Chugi Sepulveda was my graduate student, and we got some Sea Grant money, and we did an experiment where we started to look at movement patterns and depth preferences of Mako sharks. Chugi introduced me to Dan Cardamil. Dan Cardamil came into my laboratory, and Dan picked up where Chugi left off, and he started his work on thresher sharks. And we started in 2005 the Southern California Bite Elasmobranch Consortium, established in 2005. Mission statement, focus on research defining essential habitats of elasmobranchs, making the population health status of sharks, and raise an issue of public concern. So here's Dan's work on thresher sharks. Threshers have these enormous tails. These enormous tails they use to swat their prey, bat them, and then turn around and eat them. Normally, when Dan works at sea, he catches sharks because they come up and hit the bait with their tail. He pulls them up tail first. But then once he gets them alongside, he does experiments. He mounts probes on them that allow him to tell where those sharks go. What our major focus for both the Mako work and the thresher work has been the effect of the California driftline fishery on Mako captures and thresher captures. Here's data when this fishery first opened. The numbers of millions of pounds of threshers taken went way up. It fell way down. And now it's regulated, and here it is down in this particular region. And the way this works is that these drift gill nets are set at night. They're set about 11 meters below the surface so that marine mammals can get by. These are gill nets. Anything caught in them is captured. The main target is swordfish, but bycatch is then threshers and makos. And the consequence of this, and also blue sharks, I might add, threshers and makos come back to the market. We can go down and buy them and have a nice dinner. The blue sharks get thrown over. And the last time I looked, the calculated take was every time one of these nets goes in the water, which is at about this time at night, stays there till dawn, every net goes in, eight blue sharks are killed. Now, what Dan did was he brought threshers alongside. He put various kinds of tracking devices on them. This is a, what we call an acoustic transmitter. It monitors. It allows you with a hydrophone to follow the shark. Here's an archival tag. Put this on. Never see the shark again. When fishermen find it, they bring in the tag. We give them a reward. Dan and his colleagues put out almost 60 of these tags and got back 5, which is pretty remarkable, 8%. And these download information about where this shark goes for a period of time. Also, most recently, Dan has used pop-off satellite tags, attaches them to the young sharks, lets them go, finds out where the shark goes. The satellite pops off, gives information to the satellite, and so on. Here are tracking records. Acoustic and archival studies show that larger sharks move offshore, caught. Smaller threshers are, however, are in contrast in close to the shore like this. And what Dan did was to say, okay, here's the Southern California bite, this area that encompasses this region. Dan said, well, what about what's happening in Mexico? What's happening in the south of the border? Fisheries data, U.S. fisheries data is just like this. We don't know anything down here. So we worked up some relationships with scientists in Ensenada and students, and Dan put on some telemetry tags here, some satellite tags, launched them up here, and these went down. And in fact, he picked up baby threshers here and also in Ensenada just south of the border. So the conclusion of that work is, in fact, that these animals are, in fact, moving down the coastline and occupying a nursery area, youngsters, all along in here like this, down to Vizcayano Bay. And a part of the study is Dan and his colleagues in Mexico started going to all these fishing camps and looking and censusing to see what was taken. Here's all the camps that Dan has visited for his doctoral research all along through, including Laguna Manuela, and which is the one he's done most of his work at. And here's what comes up day in and day out, young threshers coming in, hammerheads, mako or two back there, all these sharks coming in, stingray or shovel-nosed guitar fish over there coming in, and in terms of young juvenile threshers, 99% of the ones that coming in are sexually immature. So the conclusion here is that there's a nursery area. Large females come up here and lay their, do their pupping up in here, but also all along here there's pupping being done. Californians, U.S., worry about regulating the thresher fishery without any real knowledge of what's happening down here, and now we've got information showing the threshers are there. The last project I'll talk to you tonight about is Andy Nosal's work. Andy is a third-year doctoral student studying the leopard sharks that occur right off the beach and tennis club in the marine room. Here's a picture from 1906 and a picture from 2006. And this is a picture that verifies Graham's law of biomass on beaches. Because if you look out here, you can count up these cows and see how much they weighed. You can count out here and count up all these people, and it's exactly the same mass. Now, what's this old picture circa 1905 shows La Jolla here, and what you can't barely make out is that where La Jolla Shores is now, there was a series of inlets and water and estuary-like conditions and small enclosures of water. And we don't know to what extent the historic presence of these kinds of things could influence the movement of leopard sharks, but we do know large numbers of leopard sharks accumulate in this area. So Andy has started a project where he's actually tagging these guys up in the area around the marine room and tracking them using the same tracking methods that Dan Cardamil used to track the threshers. But Andy's gone a step further. Here's the kind of data he gets. Here's Flat Rock, which is up by Del Mar, all the way down to SIO Pier. Here's a matter of a period of time when the shark moves along like this. Andy can record a series of data parameters for this and come up with an idea about where these sharks are. And based on his 2008 summary work, here's the beach and tennis club, here's the marine room, and here's this major concentration of these leopard sharks right in this region. Most of them are females. Now, leopard sharks occur all along the coast, and they concentrate, of course, the females concentrate in this particular area. And now, Andy, with his summer students, has gone out and put out these listening stations. This is a massive amount of work that he and his student helpers have done. And so in addition to doing active tracking of leopard sharks, males and females, he's now set up a series of acoustic monitoring stations. So if a shark swims down from Del Mar, it will be recorded at these different positions all the way down to near Imperial Beach near the Tijuana River. And so the kinds of things that Andy wants to accomplish is he wants to have these listening stations, and he wants to record leopard sharks' presence. He wants to determine if the leopards are here all year round or where they go. After all, these leopard sharks have been known here for 30, 40, 50 years. We don't really know a lot about the biology of what drives them to aggregate there in the summer months, or if they're there in the winter. And so he'll determine movement patterns of these animals. My feeling is that probably a lot of these little embayments, which there were many more of in the past time, are places for these animals to turn in. Here's the kind of rigging he's put out, a little sensor here, float. Here's a picture of these guys working at sea doing this. Here's the weight, here's the sensor, here's the float. This goes down submerged, it's a listening station. The shark passes within 500 meters of this, he'll know it. You have opportunities to adopt a shark. Andy's looking for help with his project for leopard sharks, and you can talk to him if you want. Andy's here, so he can talk to you about that. So we're going to end there. In summary, a lot of interesting things going on in shark biology. Scripps Institution of Oceanography, I'm proud to say, has had a very fundamental role in many aspects of shark biology over the years. And sharks are threatened by overfishing. They are no longer the dominant predators of the sea. And my hope is that 1,000 years from now, there will be people studying the physiology of sharks. But that will take active steps now to conserve these animals. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.